Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Back in 2009, the Department of Homeland Security released a report stating white supremacy is the country's biggest domestic terror threat. The report said white supremacists, radical anti-abortionists, and a few disgruntled veterans were most susceptible to recruitment by extremist groups. Lone wolves pose the most threat because of their low profile and autonomy. Republicans blasted the Obama administration for that report, forcing then Secretary Janet Napolitano to withdraw the report and apologize to veterans. So that was back in 2009. In 2017, the FBI reported that white supremacists posed a persistent threat of lethal violence that has produced more fatalities than any other category of domestic terrorists since 2000, according to a brand new report from Michael German, a former FBI agent and now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. White supremacists and militias have infiltrated law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the past two decades. As we know, Donald Trump has made the threat of Antifa and far-left groups a central theme of his reelection campaign. But a database of nearly 900 politically motivated attacks and plots in the United States since 1994 shows zero people were killed by anti-fascist attacks since 94. 329 people were killed by white supremacists and right-wing extremists. The database was compiled by the Center for Strategic and International Studies and reviewed by The Guardian. Between 2016 and 2018, Americans witnessed a major upswing in street mobilization by far-right groups, making it one of the most active periods of on-the-ground extremist activity in decades, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. The report says this period of extremism harbors an increased threat of violence. The center says a number of white nationalist groups dramatically rose under Trump, but many members now say he no longer stands by them. So joining us to talk about all of this are two guests. Jason Wilson is an independent journalist based in Portland, Oregon. He reports on the political right, from far-right extremist groups to radical right street protests. Jason is a contributor to The Guardian, and you can read his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Jason. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
We are also joined by Dr. Peter Simi, an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Chapman University. Dr. Simi has studied extremist groups and violence for more than 20 years. He is co-author of the book American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Hi, Dr. Simi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ruth.
Well, why don't we start off by talking about why the United States government releases reports about white supremacists and far-right groups and then refuses to do anything about it. Dr. Simi, in the case of the Obama administration, when this report came out in 2009, you had Republicans and right-wing media just going after them and forcing them to apologize to veterans. What really stands out for you about what happened back then?
Well, it was a missed opportunity. You know, it was a real missed opportunity. The report itself, if you read it, it's, you know, available online for listeners who haven't read it. It's a pretty innocuous report. It shouldn't have generated the kind of backlash that it did. But unfortunately, people, I think, took it out of context and took advantage of an opportunity to claim that the report was essentially suggesting that, you know, veterans in general were prone and susceptible to becoming right-wing extremists, as opposed to what the report actually says, which is that white supremacist groups in particular have talked about recruiting veterans for decades. And of course, you can find many instances of white supremacist groups doing that, you know, for a long, long time. And there's lots of evidence about that. And so, you know, unfortunately, what was really a fairly sober report, you know, became a political opportunity for folks to kind of make hay out of. And as a result, we lost an opportunity to really try and make some traction about what is a very substantial problem and has been for a long, long time.
Yeah. What would you add, Jason? What are your thoughts on that and why the government releases these reports but fails to do anything about it?
Well, I think the United States government is a very big thing, and any given institution within this government is very large, and you know, there are competing agendas and competing ideas within those institutions. I think what we've seen over the last year or two is a slight improvement in the sense that, you know, we have seen agencies like the FBI, you know, finally taking this threat seriously. And so members of groups like Adam Waffen Division and the base have been subject to arrest for various things and charges for various things that they've done. But, yeah, I think that, you know, during this period of the Trump administration, the whole issue of white supremacist terror and violence has been politicized and has been seen, I think, by some in the administration as a political problem, you know, for the president. So, you know, some people in the administration, I think, are not very enthusiastic about law enforcement agencies or investigative bodies in the United States government really taking this problem on.
Let's also go back to what happened after Barack Obama was elected as the country's first black president in 2008. The Southern Poverty Law Center study that I cited said that this was a boon for the radical right. There were so many incidents. Conservative media outlets really gave oxygen to nativist and anti-Muslim conspiracy theories. And then we have to remember the birther conspiracy that was championed by Donald Trump. Dr. Simi, can you talk about the significance of this and, you know, just what really was unleashed after Obama was elected?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. To understand what's happening today, you really do need to go back to at least 2008 with Obama's election and our first black president. And, you know, the night of the election, Stormfront, one of the largest white supremacist web forums at the time, you know, literally shut down because of the traffic that crashed the server. And so, yes, there was this really substantial increase in a whole host of different types of far-right extremists after the election, certainly an increase in white supremacists, a real kind of broader fear about this idea that Obama's coming for our guns. And so you saw a huge increase in gun purchases and a lot of groups really kind of rallying around the Second Amendment. You saw a huge increase in the so-called patriot militia-type groups that kind of made a resurgence in the post-2008 period of time after the election, and all this huge ecosystem of far-right extremism has just been getting these consistent shots of adrenaline since 2008. The idea of demographic change is coming to fruition, different types of kind of social changes, issues around immigration and the border, different types of technological changes that allow these groups to kind of advance their ideas and shape narratives and spread conspiracy theories. You know, these things just have all kind of coalesced over the last, 10 to 15 years in a way that now we have this ecosystem that's literally on fire.
Right. And I don't mean to offend anyone, but I was watching a documentary from Frontline last night. I think it's called Divided, about Obama and then Trump. And I mean, just to be reminded of how ugly and racist things were after Obama was elected, even from the Tea Party, where they held signs with photos of monkeys. I mean, just really horrific racist signs. Jason, what would you add about how these groups really flourished under the Obama administration?
Look, I'd agree with everything that Professor Simi said, and just add two things. I mean, there was perhaps an expectation or a conventional wisdom that, you know, after the election of a Republican president, that siege mentality, you know, amongst white conservative Americans may ease. The great political achievement, if you want to call it that, I think, of President Trump has been to nurture that siege mentality and that feeling of being locked out of power, even when he's in the White House. And for a time, Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. He was still able to nurture with ideas like the deep state, and various conspiracy theories. He was still able to promote this idea amongst his constituency that somehow they were locked out of power. And so what that meant was that the periods of you know, the Obama administration and all of those factors that Professor Zinni just mentioned really just laid down the infrastructure, really, for, you know, the street protest groups that we can probably, that we see, you know, in Portland, where I am, and other cities, entering into confrontations with left-wing protesters. You know, really, that you can trace that back to the Tea Party and the explosion, really, of far-right groups, of white nationalist ideology. You know, the mainstreaming of so much of that can also be traced to that sort of explosion in response to Obama. And I think, you know, we can see the entire Trump presidency and everything that's brought with it as a kind of reaction, really, to the Obama administration.
The report also points out that the day after Trump's 2015 presidential campaign announcement, Dylan Roof, a white supremacist who was radicalized online, murdered 9 black congregants at their church in Charleston. Dr. Zinni, can you talk about the differences between militia groups that are organized and then lone, you know, people like Dylan Roof, who reportedly was radicalized online? How do you look at these differently, the groups versus people who kill and take action on their own?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the first things to point out is that, you know, we've used this term lone wolf in the past. More recently, folks will often use the term lone actor. And technically speaking, a person like Roof commits the violence alone, but they're really not alone. And so that's one of the important things to recognize and acknowledge about these types of incidents of terrorism, is that the individuals may commit the crimes alone, but they're not really alone. They're part of a much larger kind of cultural, social system, political movement that actually provides directives. So for a long time, white supremacists have been promoting the idea of single individuals going out and committing acts of violence, because it's harder for law enforcement to prevent that from happening than, say, opposed to a larger group where it's easier to have infiltration and develop confidential informants and so forth. So this is a strategy. It's a tactic. And individuals like Roof and more recent perpetrators like we saw in El Paso and Pittsburgh and elsewhere, who have committed similar types of violent attacks, inspired by this larger cause of white supremacy, they need to be seen within that larger cause, and so that the individuals are actually connected to groups, if not directly off the ground, through, you know, different types of inspirational manifestos, through different types of speeches, by communicating with folks online. So Roof was in communication with a number of different groups through different web forums and so forth. Now, more recently, they're communicating through things like 4 and 8chan, or using different platforms like Telegram, where there's a lot of different types of communication going back and forth that's really essentially supporting the idea of committing these types of acts of violence. So the groups play into that, but then can be shielded from the violence when it's committed only by a single individual, and they're not as likely to be held responsible either criminally or civilly. Although, you know, there have been instances where there have been successful attempts to do that, and there have been groups that have been held responsible for violent acts committed by either members or folks associated with the group. But the groups and the individuals interact together in that kind of back and forth way.
And Dr. Zinni, since you have studied extremist groups for more than 20 years, you've been doing this before the rise of social media, and we're going to do a whole show about how people go down this rabbit hole of extremism online. But can you just talk about what change you've seen? I mean, I'm sure it was drastic from, you know, the time when people did not have access to YouTube and all of these far-right online media sources to today, when it's pretty pervasive.
Yeah. I started monitoring these groups in 1996, shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing. The internet was in the early days, and that's where I first started, was by, you know, doing simple keyword searches on various internet browsers to try and find websites associated with these types of groups, and was able to do it quite easily. And of course, the early days of the internet really signaled some important changes. Of course, even a precursor to the internet, you had white supremacists in the 1980s on electronic bulletin boards. And so they were really kind of early risers in the sense of understanding this technology is going to have profound implications for our movement and for our opportunity to disseminate messages and get our ideas out there to try and recruit a larger swath of the white population to galvanize folks to spread conspiracy theories. So they really early on understood the potential and took advantage of it. Now, more recently, what we've seen with different types of platforms that have emerged, like YouTube, as you mentioned, is that they've continued this longstanding understanding of how to use this technology, and they've just been able to kind of jump right in and utilize it. So, for instance, Twitter, white supremacists were very active early on in Twitter, actually even, according to some studies, outperforming ISIS on Twitter. So, they understand the technology of how the hashtags work and how to spread their ideas. They have a very vibrant troll culture that is very good, unfortunately, at harassing people and intimidating people online. And so, again, all of this is part of this ecosystem that has just been allowed to fester, and now we're seeing what we're seeing, which is it's hard to even think about how to start countering this because for so long we've neglected it. Mm.
Jason, what would you add?
I think that's all spot on. I mean, they're becoming more sophisticated, I think, all the time in their use of technology. And, they're developing better methods of operational security. They're using, encrypted messaging services. They're using, services like Telegram, which are kind of almost beyond the reach of U.S. law enforcement in many ways. I'd probably go even further than Dr. Simi in saying that with respect to the groups, the groups themselves, I think a lot of these folks have worked out that the groups actually, having a group, an organization, constitutes a bit of a vulnerability. And, the groups are almost beside the point now when you look at something like Telegram. It's this kind of ecosystem of radicalization promoting their ideology, of putting together looser kind of networks of people who have a kind of affinity, and then now and again you find that someone arises out of that and goes off to commit a kind of what looks like a lone act of violence, but is actually a product of this ecosystem.
Jason, have you interviewed many of these members?
I've talked to a few. My reporting more recently has kind of focused on myself on using, the tools that we have available in terms of digital technologies to really find out more about what these folks are doing and to monitor them more effectively and, to identify, the leaders of these groups. So earlier this year, I identified the leader of the base, which is an accelerationist, terrorism-inclined group. I have talked to them. Talking to them is pretty tedious because they tend to all sort of say the same things. They nurture the same conspiracy theories. They have the same fears. They have a lot of the time the same objectives. Those objectives and fears and conspiracy theories have been consistent, for decades now, really, and you'll find that the guys today are explicitly harking back to people like James Mason, who's still alive but was most active, during the 1970s, 1980s. The ideas don't change much, the delusions don't change much. What has changed is a technological infrastructure that enables them to operate more effectively more. In a more robust way, in a lot of ways.
And Dr. Simi, how should we think about these groups and who they are? I mean, you often hear about the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, Patriot Prayer. Are they very distinct? Or do they go from one group to another? How should we think about these groups?
Yeah, I just want to underscore one point that I think is really essential that Jason just made that somewhat answers part of the question, is that this is not a movement about groups per se as much as it's about ideas. It's about how to kind of get ideas out there to shape narratives, to kind of affect how the consciousness of people. I mean, it's really an effort to raise awareness about certain issues that's promoted largely through ideas, and the shape and the form and what the ideas look like may change due to technological changes, because the groups may change, leaders may change, people come and go, but the core part of the ideas, as Jason just mentioned, really don't change much over time. They really have certain kind of common denominators that remain fairly consistent over time. And so I think, you know, we see some of these groups and we try and make sense out of it, and it can be difficult at times, and you get groups like the Proud Boys that claim, you know, we're not white supremacists, despite the founder of the group, Gavin McGinnis, you know, writing an essay, 10 Reasons Why I Hate Jews, which he then fairly quickly changes to from Jews to Israel. But, you know, and you see, aspects of the Proud Boys, which clearly have, you know, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim aspects, and yet they're so very vehement about claiming that we're not, really racist and so forth, and certainly not white supremacists, because we have actual members who aren't white necessarily. And so, you know, there's lots of, I think, confusion about this. But if you really kind of focus in on core aspects of the ideas, I think that helps bring a little bit more clarity. And so, again, when you have a founder that writes an essay, 10 Reasons Why I Hate Jews, it's hard to dispute the fact that that's a clear, you know, example of anti-Semitism. And so, you know, when you look at those kind of specific instances, I think you can get to a little bit better understanding of, okay, a lot of these groups say one thing, but if you look kind of behind the scenes, it's clear that what they're saying in terms of their front stage, attempt to create good, you know, kind of public relations and appear a certain way is not very accurate. And there's quite a pretty intensive strategy. They talk about optics. And this we saw in Charlottesville with the idea that we were going to show up in khakis and polos and appear a certain way as a way to try and deceive people, essentially, about what these core ideas are that are really driving them.
That is Jason Wilson, an independent journalist based in Portland. He reports on the political right, from far-right extremist groups to radical right street protests. Dr. Peter Simi is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Chapman University. He is co-author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Dr. Simi has studied extremist groups and violence for more than 20 years. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, what do you want to know about these groups? We're going to talk about their connection to law enforcement, and then we'll talk about what their plans are for the election. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Simi, can you also talk about the changes you've seen when it comes to violence? Because the Southern Poverty Law Center's report looked at groups that tend to stay underground, groups that might put on the khakis and the white polo and march, and then groups that come for a fight, which is what we've seen a lot in the last year or so, brutal fights on the streets, and then people who actually take it further and kill, like we've talked about a couple of instances. In fact, you recently testified about what happened in 2017, the Portland Max train attack, when Jeremy Christian was arrested for fatally stabbing two men and injuring another after they confronted him for menacing two black Muslim women on a train in Portland. And before you talk about what that experience was like, can you talk about when and why these groups go from, you know, going underground to actually committing violence and actually murdering people?
Yeah, well, these types of individuals and groups and, the far-right extremism as a whole are involved in lots of different types of violence, I think, as you've just referenced here. And so I think that's important to recognize. It's not that there's one type of violence that characterizes these types of folks. It's really broad-based, and it's different situations. You'll see different types of violence emerge. As the kind of larger social political context changes, you'll see trends in certain types of violence. We saw after Charlottesville, you know, a series of these kind of single actor violent attacks in the year to 2 years following Charlottesville. That, you know, it's hard to say that, you know, it's directly as a result, but that you know, Charlottesville was kind of a culmination of a series of public events where violence was often part of those events in Sacramento, Anaheim, Berkeley, and various other cities kind of leading up to Charlottesville. We saw similar types of public events that resulted in pretty serious violence often. So you have the violence that occurs at the public rallies. You have the single actors who are acting on behalf of the larger. You have more spontaneous incidents of violence, where we saw with Jeremy Christian in Portland, where you have, you know, unfortunate kind of circumstances that come together, and an individual influenced it to some extent, at least based on their beliefs, it acts violently in that situation. So, you know, one of the things that's hard about this movement, these set of actors, is that because they are involved in so many different types of violence, you can't have a single strategy to counter that, because, you know, you have to have a kind of multi-pronged strategy to address it.
And what would you add, Jason, because you're in Portland, where we're seeing so many fights happening on the streets.
Yeah, well, those fights have been, you know, really going on since 2017, and you know, there were particularly bad ones, bad sort of running brawls in late 2017. There was an extremely violent riot and street fight in 2018, and you know, we go through this cycle where there's an act of violence like Jeremy Christian's, which then becomes the kind of the kind of focus of organizing around the country, and so you'll have this each summer. We've had this gradual escalation in street violence, which has culminated in a national mobilization of groups like the Proud Boys, who then descend on the city for this, you know, this kind of spectacle of confrontation, of street confrontation. As we've been saying, you know, the ideas don't change much, and a lot of the time what they say about their ideas is actually obfuscation. But you know, if you look at what they do, that's also very consistent. I mean, these movements are all about violence and creating opportunities for violence. And you know, action, this idea of taking action and taking possession of the streets and using violence to do so, it comes up over and over again. So, you know, in my reporting, I try, explain the ideological labels when I have to, but I think it's really good for all of us to not get lost in, you know, a semantic debate about what these groups are as against what they say about themselves, but really focus in on what they do. And, mm-hmm. and you'll find time and time again that what they do and what they want to do is violence.
Let's talk about the relationship between these groups and law enforcement. I'd like to get you both to respond to what we saw on the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin, when Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old self-described member of a militia, shot three protesters and killed two. We saw a video of a National Guard and one of their big Humvees hand out water to various armed militia white men, including Kyle, and saying that we appreciate what you guys are doing here. What was your response to that, Dr. Simi?
Well, troubling to say the least. This type of kind of cozying up to armed vigilantes is obviously a recipe for disaster, and of course we saw that disaster come to fruition in Kenosha, and it's going to continue to happen in cities across the country if this is allowed to remain the strategy for law enforcement. Equally troubling, the videos after he's killed two people and injured a third, with an AR-15 wrapped around his neck and his left hand touching that AR-15 at various points in time as he breaches a police perimeter, and they ask him for directions about where the injured are, where the victims are. And then he's allowed to essentially walk back to his car and then eventually, head home. That is deeply troubling, given just a couple days prior we saw the video of what happened to Jacob Blake, who's trying to move away from law enforcement, not breaching a perimeter, but trying to get away. and unarmed, not carrying an AR-15, and obviously, you know, shot multiple times in the back. So to have those two contrasts in the same city, same police department, so close together, the videos, to see that, such a different response, it really speaks volumes about the problem that we're facing.
Right. And Jason, Michael German, a former FBI special agent who's written extensively on this, has a new report out at the Brennan Center for Justice saying that white supremacist groups have infiltrated law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. In 2010, the Portland Police Bureau suspended officers for erecting the Nazi shrine. In July 2020, four officers in San Jose were suspended pending investigations into their participation in a Facebook group that posts racist and anti-Muslim content. I mean, there are so many examples of this in his report.
Yeah, I mean, look... we've also had, you know, several police officers around the country in recent years, you know, who have been found to be members of the Proud Boys or the Three Percenters militia. Yeah, the list goes on. Look, I think that, unfortunately, there is both active attempts at infiltration by far-right activists into police forces and into the armed forces, you know, because they see the benefits of having, you know, sympathetic people in those organizations. But, you know, that's not all of it. I mean, I think that there are some people who are drawn into that kind of work for the same reason that they're drawn to far-right ideologies. They are authoritarian. You know, they're inclined to authoritarianism. They're inclined to violence. And you know, they see an opportunity to, you know, to direct, you know, law enforcement or violence at communities of color. So, yeah, this is not all police officers, obviously, but the remainder of their colleagues and their superior officers need to take this extremely seriously and need to have zero tolerance for anyone you know, who holds those kinds of ideologies working in law enforcement, because it's just completely destructive to any kind of trust that the community might have in police forces.
Dr. Simi, what would you add?
Well, this is a really entrenched problem. I think Jason, you know, summarizes it really well, that it's both a reflection of a longstanding, again, decades-long at least, of white supremacist groups leaders explicitly telling adherents that the best thing to do is grow your hair out, you know, referencing skinheads, young skinheads, grow your hair out, don't get tattoos, cover them up if you have them, and, you know, get into the military, get into law enforcement, become a teacher, become a doctor, become a lawyer, you know, essentially infiltrate society and use it to our advantage. So this is piece of it, but then as Jason mentions, that's not the whole thing, is that you have folks who are in law enforcement that aren't affiliated directly with any of these groups, but they essentially adhere to the same principles, the same beliefs, and that motivates this type of animus that affects the way they do their job, and we see, you know, this tragically play out time and time again. You know, white supremacist violence, in my mind, is the only form of terrorism in our country's history that has been state-sanctioned. And we've seen that at local and state and federal levels, you know, manifest itself. So, you know, we just, you know, there's been far too much of our history where local law enforcement has had, for instance, Klan membership very prominent, you know, within departments across the country, not just confined to the Deep South, but across the country. Mm. So it's a deeply entrenched problem that we've never really addressed.
Before we let you both go, what do you expect these groups to do around the election? I found a new group yesterday called American Contingency. It was started by Mike Glover, who is a former Green Beret and CIA contractor. Their slogan is Prepare, Mobilize, Defend. Their website has a countdown to Election Day with the message, Will You Be Ready? Their mission statement basically says that the international elite, in collusion with international progressive and Islamo-fascist elements seek to overthrow the U.S. to establish a Marxist New World Order. Haaretz reports that fascist QAnon believers, military veterans, and former law enforcement are all active participants. Dr. Simi, what are you hearing out there about what these groups are planning around the election?
Well, it's, red alert, so to speak. And my concern is the election's going to, I think we're in for a real tough couple months in the lead up to the election, but I think it's actually post-election that we're going to really be in a world of hurt potentially if we're not prepared. I think it's the, period between the election, irregardless of the results, and the weeks and months following the election. If Trump is reelected, that's going to have a hugely empowering and emboldening effect on a segment of these folks. And if the polls are correct and Biden's elected, I think you're going to have a contingent of folks that support Trump that sound like what you're just referring to. But folks that in that period up leading up to the transition, I think we could see some really, really substantial violence, and things could get even worse than they already are, as we speak.
And Jason, a group called Hawkfish, which studies analytic data, says that Trump could possibly, quote, win on election night. But once you count the mail-in ballots, Biden would win. But that would take a couple of weeks. And that could also be pretty ugly. Just briefly, what are your thoughts?
Oh, there's no, whichever way, whatever outcome we get from the election, I have to agree with Dr. Simi. We're in for a very, very rocky period, and I would say, at least the next year or so, right through to the end of next summer, I think that rocky period has already started in Kenosha and Portland, and we're just going to see more of that, and we really need to be ready, I think, for a prolonged period of, extremely polarized, extremely tense, and potentially violent events in our streets and elsewhere.
Wow. Well, we want to have you back because we really need to talk about how to prepare for this, the media, politicians. We need to really start talking about this. So thank you so much for your work. Jason Wilson is an independent journalist based in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Peter Simi is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Chapman University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
And we will definitely continue to follow this issue in the coming weeks and months. Coming up after a quick break, we are going to get the latest on the eviction crisis. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.